Well, just one day after making the top 16 of American Idol, Park City resident Wyatt Pike dropped out of the competition. Idol host Ryan Seacrest made the announcement at the beginning of Monday night's show on ABC. "I have to tell you that finalist Wyatt Pike will not be competing in the competition," he said. "He had to drop out, but we wish him the very best." The night before, 24 finalists were narrowed to 16 during a two-hour broadcast. Pike was the second-to-last contestant in his group to advance. The judges complimented Pike's performance of "You Somebody" by Kings of Leon. Katy Perry called him an authentic singer-songwriter and implied he was a leader in the competition. Luke Bryan said Pike was going to, quote, "be able to do music for the rest of his life." And Lionel Richie said Pike had a style the judges liked to watch, and the 20-year-old was on his way to something big. As of late Monday evening, Pike has been silent about his departure from the show. The last activity from Pike on social media was a post he made last Wednesday with pictures of the Park City area, saying, quote, "something to feel this through, home. Thankful for the roller coaster I'm on today." KPCW has tried to reach Pike and a publicist from American Idol who had helped facilitate interviews with Pike during the show, but has not received any reply. Up until last year, Pike was a volunteer DJ at KPCW. He spoke to KPCW's Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour on March 26th about his experience on American Idol. People magazine reports that an American Idol representative said Wyatt could not continue due to personal reasons. Well, with the state's mask mandate expired on April 10th, Summit County Sheriff Justin Martinez says we are entering the next phase of the pandemic. The sheriff says the community has done a very good job responding to the crisis. He hopes citizens will continue to practice tolerance and civility. Rick Bruff has more.
The sheriff recently spoke to Randy Barton on the Local View. A mask order is not being mandated by the state of Utah or by Summit County, but Martinez said that local businesses have the right to require masks on their premises. In a way, he said, it's carrying on an old tradition.
You heard the old saying, no shoes, no shirt, no service. You know, a business has a right to refuse service to anybody they choose, and so if a business decides that they want to implement or require masks, they absolutely have that right. And if people come into their establishment and are not wearing masks, at that point, the business owners can ask them to leave. And if they refuse to leave, because I've heard, well, it's my right to eat here. It's not. It's your choice to eat there. It's the business individual that has a right to refuse service to you. And so if we get a call that someone's not wearing a mask, we can trespass them off the property.
He asked locals to practice what he calls mask tolerance.
For those individuals that want to wear a mask, and for those individuals that choose not to wear a mask, everybody's right and everybody's wrong. And so I hope this community, and I believe we have done a really good job, and I don't anticipate, and there's nothing that would give me any indication that we do anything other than be tolerant here, but my hope is that we start a tolerance campaign towards, if you want to wear a mask, knock yourself out and don't get on somebody because they are wearing a mask, and vice versa. If somebody's not wearing a mask, it's not your place to tell them you have to wear a mask. Why aren't you wearing a mask?
On a related note, he said that vaccination efforts have gone very well for his department and for inmates at the jail.
I was hoping for 100, but we had 80% of the sheriff's office get vaccinated. Some of those that chose not to get vaccinated were those that had said they already had COVID and didn't feel like they needed to, right or wrong, but that they didn't do that. At the jail population, we have probably about 90% of the jail population that's been vaccinated. The really, really good news is that Summit County, the jail, did not have one case of COVID through the jail. The way we chose to bring people in and isolate them for 7 days and do the rapid testing on them before we put them in general population. So we didn't have zero spread in the jail. And I also, I'm very proud to report that with my deputies, I didn't have a single case of spread within the sheriff's office.
The sheriff said that hopefully his officers will soon be able to participate in local parades. He said there's light at the end of the tunnel, but he added a caveat.
I think if we stay focused and we stay tolerant and we stay positive, you know, hopefully by midsummer, July, it will even be in a much better position. I believe that moving forward, probably for the rest of my life, is that we're going to have the cold, flu, and coronavirus season. I don't think this is going to go away permanently anytime soon, unfortunately.
Summit County Sheriff Justin Martinez. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the statewide mask mandate ended on April 10th, and Summit and Wasatch counties have not extended a limited order for face coverings. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on the new health order and the latest COVID-19 numbers.
A statement from Summit County thanked the public for their compliance and also said the, quote, current outlook is a result of vigilant efforts and sacrifices. County officials asked that residents respect any private companies that continue to enforce masks. Utah Governor Spencer Cox issued a statement Monday about the backlash to mandates in businesses. He said his office, quote, strongly condemns the threats of violence made against employees and businesses requiring patrons to wear masks. Individuals who make such threats will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. With the mandate ending, the Utah Department of Health announced 185 new COVID-19 cases Monday, which is about 10 more cases than the state saw at the same time last week. The 7-day rolling average for new cases is 398 per day. In the Wasatch Back, both Summit and Wasatch counties didn't see any change in cases week over week. Summit County reported 4 new cases. Wasatch County reported no new cases. There are more than 2,500 people tested for the first time statewide, with around 4,800 total tests administered. On average, just under 4% of tests over tests are coming back positive, while the average percent positivity for people over people is around 7%. Utah's Department of Health reported no new deaths. To date, more than 2,150 Utahns have died due to COVID-19. There are around 5,000 people vaccinated for COVID-19 since Sunday, bringing the total number to just over 1.7 million doses administered. Summit County has administered around 36,000 total vaccines, and Wasatch has given out more than 18,000 doses. Both counties are registering to vaccinate residents 16 years or older. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, the Summit County Council returns to session tomorrow, kicking off with a work session at 2:40 p.m. On the line with a preview of the agenda, we have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So let's talk about this master plan development process and neighborhood mixed use zone on the agenda. The council discussed the NMU zone last week. Can you tell us what significant changes were made to that?
Well, you know, it's down to some language changes at this point in order to make sure that the council feels comfortable with the intent of some of the language. We've heard them talk about setbacks. We've heard them talk about specifically, Councilmember Robinson brought up the issue of affordable housing and whether the NMU or the MPD needs to have anything specific in it in regards to some level of affordable housing in this zone or in this process. So I think that's what you're going to see discussion about this week. In the interim between weeks, staff has made the suggested changes to the document that the council discussed last week. So they'll be going over those in detail.
Mm-hmm. And in public input, you've gotten just a handful of comments, but the citizens who have spoken seem to be afraid that this new zone will jumpstart development and cause problems in the region. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it's very specific, and I think some of the confusion has been around where the neighborhood mixed use zone can be applied, and of course that is very specific within both the general plan that guides where the NMU can be done. It certainly mimics what can be done in the community commercial zone. Certainly encourages mixed use within those very specific places in the county where we can service that in a better way. But, you know, very valid comments, even though the comments have been less in the last couple of weeks, especially with the public hearing on the MPD last week. The council has been discussing this for easily 6 months or more. And had public hearings along the way where they've received very strong comments from folks. So those are all being taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. And let's look at this interlocal agreement between Summit County and High Valley Transit. Can you explain again how High Valley is an independent district when the board includes three council members, one former council member, and the district's general manager is the county's transportation manager?
Well, I mean, that's really one of the things that this document solidifies is what the relationship is between the county and the district. You know, in the interim period, and while this is formed, Caroline Rodriguez, our regional transportation director for the county, is making the transition to be the future leader of the district from a staff point of view. There is a period of time where she's kind of covering down on both positions, and this agreement then all further goes on to say how the county will provide services for a period of time. Until the district can perform those services itself, those being around the county attorney's office and the advice that the district needs in that, finances and accounting, as well as HR services. There will be a point in the future where the district will be doing that on its own. But similar to our special service districts, where the county does provide some of that support, this will stay the same. In regards to governance, you know, there's a specific statute for rural transit districts that's different than our special service districts. So that's where it's designed from, which provides its own level of independence. Certainly having, you know, it does allow for the elected body to have a certain percentage of the board that appoints the board members to be part of that. And I think in the beginnings of this, the county, given its experience in setting up districts and its the fact that the sales taxes for transit come from the county, there was a certain level of oversight that was desired. It can certainly change in the future and become more independent.
Right. And last on the agenda for tomorrow is a discussion on the While Away Ranch, which is proposed in Lower Silver Creek. This project has a bit of a ping-pong history between going back and forth in the council and the planning commission. It was supposed to be on last week's agenda. Why was it postponed, and why is it on the agenda this week?
I think there was some noticing requirements and packet requirements that were not fulfilled for last week's agenda, so we had to bring that back and repost that. Nothing other than that, really. And you know, now the council will hear this again based on the appeal of the applicant.
Mm-hmm. And not on the agenda is the Green Cemetery. The ESAP committee recommended it for $160,000. Do you have an idea of when that might come to a decision?
I don't know. That's actually a decision of the manager, so I get to bring that forward and understand what went on. You know, I'm going to have to discuss that with the Summit Land Conservancy, as well as some members of ESAP to understand, and of course staff who listened in on that discussion to make a final determination. I know that the Summit Land Conservancy was looking for a little larger amount of money from the funds that are available to ESAP to allocate. The initial reports I got were that the Eastern Summit County Ag and Open Space Preservation Group was positive about the project, but you know, they have certain limitations that they can recommend under, and then I get to act on that. So I will be studying that a little further before any decision is made.
Right. And when this project does seek planning approval, do you know what agency would do the environmental review?
You know, within the county, certainly the health department would be involved. from an advice point of view, but I believe that the state regulates cemeteries, so I believe there's a state agency that does that.
Mm-hmm. And one last topic before we let you go, your reaction to the court decision that ruled against Summit County and the Hoffvest Colby School application. Will you consider some revisions to the county code in the wake of Judge Welch's decision? Excuse me.
You know, I think it's premature to speculate on that. The ruling just came down, and of course the county is going to have to react to that. I'm going to allow our planning director to take and the attorney's office to take their first cut on that in order to advise the council.
Mm-hmm. Anything else for us this morning, Tom?
No, that's it. Just the council will declare County Government Month. The county staff and the county government have had one heck of a year, and we're just celebrating all that we do in order to provide great services to the community.
All right, Tom, thank you so much. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Summit County Council goes into session on Wednesday with a work session at 2:40 p.m. Well, water is a hot-button issue in agricultural communities across the country. And with the drought state of emergency in effect, KPCW's Jessica Lowell checked in with one North Summit County community.
The last time the city of Colville issued a water restriction was around 40 years ago. And despite the drought order, this year the city most likely won't see any issues, according to Colville Mayor Trevor Johnson.
On the culinary side, we are in great shape. We have more capacity to be able to store, and we're not concerned about the culinary system. The secondary system could play into that a little bit.
He says the secondary water supply in the city needs some work. Colville has been trying to get a grant to repair the city's pond, which can only be filled up 2/3 of the way due to leaks. He says the secondary water supply could affect the culinary supply.
If we can't pull enough secondary water out of Chalk Creek to fill our pond to keep, you know, people's lawns watered, and then people start using the culinary water, that might be where it could potentially impact it. But even then, I think we're still in a pretty good spot. So.
Johnson says the city's water prices for residents can run higher than other areas because both culinary and secondary water are on the bill. He also says the city recently updated its water infrastructure with a new sewer plant and water storage tank. These new amenities will now need to be paid off through grants and bonds, which has been a driver in the water bill costs in the city. And while Colville is still in the process of finalizing contracts for a building to treat the water for the shallow wells, Johnson says this project is the lowest on the city's priorities. They likely won't have to tap into the supply for 20 years. He feels the city shouldn't be any more worried about water supply than anywhere else in the state.
When our source runs low, it's about the time that everybody's source runs low. And if that happens sooner rather than later, for example, you know, kind of what we're gearing up for this year, we're going to be in no better or no worse shape than anybody else in the state, I think, with our secondary water.
He does say that Colville, like the rest of Utah, has a responsibility to conserve water.
I think if we can be smart in watering our fields, watering our lawns, be responsible in how we do that. But that's an age-old effort. Goes back generations and generations, and water is always a touchy subject, especially among agricultural communities.
A recent government study found rainstorms have become more erratic in the West, leading to longer droughts. As the planet continues to warm due to climate change, the U.S. Southwest is expected to experience more droughts. As summer approaches and conditions become drier, Johnson says the city will educate residents on water conservation, and if needed, they will use supplemental options to source more secondary water. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, Deer Valley made the official announcement yesterday. Major changes are coming to Snow Park Lodge. Alterra Mountain Company, owner of Deer Valley, announced Monday it plans to invest $207 million in capital improvement projects next year at four different properties, including Deer Valley. The resort plans what it calls a complete revision at Snow Park, saying it will use the current 15 acres of surface parking lots and turn it into a world-class base area with more skier services and new food and beverage options. Plans also include a ski beach, where guests will have views of the slopes. Monday's announcement did not include any information on additional lodging and retail space. However, Steve Isowitz, Deer Valley Director of Real Estate and Planning, said in an interview with KPCW, that the master plan allows for 210 residential units and roughly 20,000 square feet of commercial space. A press release from Deer Valley said the resort will remain within guidelines approved by Park City in 1977 as part of its master plan. That includes adhering to height limits and allowable square footage. The architecture of the village will also be inspired by the surrounding mountain landscape. The project also has plans for an improved transportation hub, allowing better access from the slopes to parking locations. Snow Park project manager Rich Wagner said the resort's plans are designed to be consistent with Park City's vision and values. Wagner added the project intends to be respectful of neighbors and the local community. Deer Valley is still waiting for local government review and approval. The resort said its first conditional use permit application requests permission to start construction on utilities and parking structures. For the full press release from Alterra and Deer Valley, you can visit kpcw.org. On the line, we have Dr. John Hanrahan, who is leaving his role as medical director with the People's Health Clinic. Also on the line is newly appointed medical director Mary Lining. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So John is a founding member of the People's Health Clinic. He's been involved since 1999 when he was on the board and helped kickstart the organization. John, you've had a couple of rounds with People's Health Clinic. Just to remind us that perhaps this isn't a goodbye, but see you later. Tell us about the history you have with the clinic.
Well, as you noted, we founded the clinic in 1999, and I was a volunteer for the first, 10 years. And then around 2009, I started working as a staff physician, and the last few years as the medical director. I had to take almost a year sabbatical, I would call it, to run the Utah Rotary Organization as a volunteer. But I was able to come back a little over a year ago to the clinic and take up my job as medical director, and it's been really, really amazing and interesting and something to be part of the clinic during the COVID pandemic, for sure. But this time I'm leaving for good as medical director, but I will stay on as a volunteer and continue to see patients and help in any way I can.
Wonderful. So how have things changed since those earlier days, now more than two decades ago?
Well, as you can imagine, over 20 years, it's a dramatic change. In the beginning, it was difficult for our patients to get blood tests that they needed, or x-rays they might need, or medications that they needed. And it was very frustrating because these are our neighbors and workers in our community. They didn't have insurance, and we couldn't take good care of them. And over the past 20 years, we've grown to the point where we are providing great care to people in some of Wasatch counties without insurance. And we have a wonderful staff of providers and a wonderful group of volunteers who help out, from translating to triage to nursing to blood draws to taking care of people. And it's remarkable, the growth and the change we've seen.
Right. And it also has been an unprecedented year for public and community health. I guess this question is for both of you. Kind of what trends have you seen this year in the community?
Well,
I would say, I don't know that we have the numbers yet, but the percent of uninsured in our population certainly will have increased with COVID and the financial impact that's had.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the uncovered community is back on its feet, or are we still facing big challenges due to things like vaccine acceptance, distribution, herd immunity, things like that?
There are definitely large challenges, and I think it's really important to note that a large number of the patients that we see are members of the Latinx community, many of whom are undocumented residents, and that means that they're not eligible for the Affordable Care Act. So there's not a safety net in place when these basic jobs that they've been providing in a resort town have become unavailable.
Mm-hmm. And John, how does a community health clinic play a role in public health? Does it just it seem the pandemic has shined a light on some of the most drastic shortcomings with the propensity of people of color and other minorities suffering the most from this virus?
Well, I think the People's Health Clinic is entirely about public health. You know, our mission is to provide high quality care to the uninsured in Summit and Wasatch counties. And as you mentioned and Mari mentioned, a big percentage of our patients are the Latinx immigrant community. We've seen numbers of uninsured rise dramatically in the last year, and our mission is to provide care for those people who can't otherwise access care, you know, the most vulnerable in our community. And I can't think of, you know, a better description of public health care.
Mm-hmm. So Mary, you've been a longtime volunteer medical provider at People's Health Clinic, and you're going to be taking over as medical director on April 15th, so just in a couple days from now. Your background is as an ICU director at the Park City Hospital, but now you're moving into a decidedly nonprofit, community-based medical environment. Can you talk a little bit about this decision and what you hope to accomplish at People's Health Clinic?
Sure. International health, global health has always been a passion of mine going back to actually my undergraduate work. I did work as a hospitalist for 15 years, the past eight at the Park City Hospital, where I really saw the impact of the People's Health Clinic on the community, especially when I was taking care of, you know, uninsured members of the community that otherwise wouldn't have had follow-up. And that really reignited my interest in taking care of an underserved population. And so 2 years ago, I made the decision to transition over to the People's Health Clinic full time. And I've never been more fulfilled as a provider.
Wonderful. So is the program finding more demand for free and affordable health care? Growth in the Wasatch Back would seem to drive the need for more medical services, especially for some of our more underserved populations.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we have to take into account that we have a migrant population both through the ski industry and also as undocumented residents come in and provide, you know, the working backbone of our community. And they need to have a resource for basic health care, which wouldn't exist if it were not for Dr. Hanrahan and his incredible insight. So my job is easy from the standpoint that he has created this incredible infrastructure and framework over the past 22 years, and I get to come in and expand our programming to meet this growing need.
Mm-hmm. And what is the state of health care for our portion of the community that does not have access to it, can't afford it, or has lost it to jobs leaving the area?
I mean, when you look at, like, the social determinants of health, and especially poverty, unemployment, lead to increased risk of chronic illness. And so you'll end up seeing obesity from having, you know, decreased access to healthy foods, increased blood pressure, increased risk of heart disease, increase in diabetes. And so for this population in particular, it's critically important that we have good primary health care in place to help keep people out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm. And is a community like Park City an optimal setting for a health clinic like this one? Because we have so much service industry employment, which notoriously does not provide health coverage or to seasonal or part-time employees?
It is. And I suppose that's also the paradox of Park City. You know, we live in one of the richest small towns in America, yet we have at least 2,000 to 3,000 community members in Summit County who are living below the poverty line. In fact, 5.7% of our families in Summit County are living below the poverty line. And, I mean, that plays into this kind of mobile migratory workforce that helps Park City run. And it also places Park City in an incredible position to help out these community members.
Mm-hmm. And I have to imagine that the philanthropic base of residents in the Wasatch Back, including many volunteer resources, has to be a tremendous plus for the organization.
Absolutely. That's what I love about living in Park City. It's such a well-run town with a lot of incredibly talented people who want to help.
Mm-hmm. And how difficult is it to get enough medical volunteers? Do you have a shortfall of people wanting to help out, or is it a surplus?
There is always a shortfall in that our patient population continues to grow. In particular, we have a need for subspecialty care. So, you know, any providers, especially retirees who may have moved to town to golf and ski, we would love your help even, you know, one day a month to help provide more subspecialty services.
Mm-hmm. And kind of when we talk about treatment for chronic medical conditions like diabetes and heart disease, does People's Health Clinic have ongoing care for chronic problems like these?
I'm going to jump in because I got to.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, John.
Yeah,
sorry.
I got to say that Dr. Lining has really excelled in that area for us. Last year, she started a new diabetes program at the clinic. We just got our first six-month report on our metrics, and our diabetic patients are doing dramatically better since she instituted a much more expanded program for diabetes. I think we'll see her expand that kind of programming into other chronic disease areas like hypertension and obesity and hyperlipidemia. So I'm thrilled that she's coming on board and has this capacity and ability to, you know, really expand our programming and view it from a public health perspective.
Sounds great. So as we're on the topic of these more long-term conditions, what happens when someone comes in with something a little more serious or even terminal? Is that a People's Health Clinic scope of care, or are they then referred to an actual hospital?
Well,
so we get a lot of support. Oh, sorry, go ahead and take that, John.
Go ahead, Maureen.
I was just going to say, we get a lot of support from Intermountain Healthcare in particular. So if we have somebody, for example, diagnosed with cancer, we can refer them into the Intermountain Healthcare Network and also the University of Utah Network to help them, you know, get the more advanced services that they need. But there is a challenge in making sure that they can afford, you know, the treatment options available.
Mm-hmm. Anything else either of you guys would like to add before we let you go this morning?
Yeah, I want to just say, you know, this has been a passion of mine for 22 years, and I can't think of anyone I'd rather have take over as medical director than Dr. Lining. Our staff and our volunteers and our patients all love her. She's, you know, one of the brightest doctors I've ever met. It's been a joy to work with her, and I think most importantly, she has this passion for healthcare for the most vulnerable in our community, and that's what we need here, and we're just really thrilled to have her.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Hanrahan and Dr. Lining, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. That's Dr. John Hanrahan and Dr. Mary Lining of People's Health Clinic here in Park City. Dr. Lining will be taking over as the new medical director of the clinic in just 2 days, on Thursday. Well, last week, the Summit Land Conservancy announced it's partnering with the Ogden Valley Land Trust to protect the 1,080-acre property once home to a therapist monk monastery. Carolyn Murray has this.
The Abbey of Our Lady of the Holy Trinity was a Trappist Cistercian monastery settled in 1947 in Huntsville, Utah. The monks were farming, ranching, and keeping bees, and known for their locally produced creamed honey. In 2016, Huntsville resident Bill White purchased the monastery and the land. All in their 80s, the monks have moved to an assisted living center in Salt Lake City. Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, said the Ogden Valley Land Trust approached them to help them obtain a conservation easement on the land. She said the property was expensive and Fox's staff thought it would be a good way to partner with the all-volunteer open space group based in Weber County.
In order to save it, it required, you know, another huge federal grant of the magnitude that the Osgathorpe 160 grant was. And an all-volunteer organization didn't really have the capacity to put in that kind of a federal federal grant. So the Summit Land Conservancy wrote that grant, and we were here today because we've learned that that grant has been awarded, and that's $8.8 million. The total project cost, which includes the purchase price plus transaction costs, is $9.5 million.
Under the conservation easement, the landowners would retain the property, but it would be under an easement protecting it from development. Fox said Summit Land Conservancy was able to write a big federal grant, but they're looking to the Ogden Valley Land Trust to help supplement another $700,000 towards the conservation easement purchase.
You know, a portion of it will come from other grants, but yeah, we do hope that they will bring in, you know, through a fundraising campaign in the Ogden Valley, a fairly significant amount of money. You know, in this situation, the landowner is donating 58% of the easement value. But often our landowners, it's somewhere between about 35 and 25% that they donate. So this is a big contribution from this landowner. He's also spent millions of dollars installing new irrigation systems.
The landowners have had to tear down old buildings that made up the cloisters and the church, which were filled with asbestos and faulty wiring.
You know, he's really restoring, renovating, upgrading the property so that it can be a long-term organic farm, actually, on over 1,000 acres.
You can find more information about saving the Huntsville Monastery on the Summit Land Conservancy's website. A link is on kpcw.org, along with a slideshow of photos of the monks and the property. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, PC CAPS, which stands for the Center for Advanced Professional Studies, is an elective for 11th and 12th graders in which students develop real-world skills. They're working on real-world projects for companies and organizations. Project types fall within the industry fields of engineering, coding, business solutions, health sciences, digital design, and primary education. Park City CAPS is one of dozens of CAPS programs around the country. John Trahan is the PC CAPS Pitch Contest Project Organizer, and Don Roll is one of the mentors who has helped students through the mentorship program at PC CAPS. They're both joining us on the Local News Hour this morning to talk about this inaugural contest. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Hi.
All right, John, let's start with you. It looks like you have six or so students who will have about 15 minutes each to present their great ideas.
Yes, so at first there were 15 students who entered this competition, and then it was culled down to about six. And so right now they're working on their projects. They all have established businesses, or at least business ideas, and they are getting ready to pitch their idea in the contest tomorrow at 3 o'clock. So very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And these projects are fully developed at this point, or are there still some rough around the edges parts that needs to be smoothed out before they're ready to go?
So I would say there are businesses either that there's a variety. There's a few students in this competition that actually have businesses already established, and there's a few that this is their kickstart. This is their way to get their ideas out, the way to start their business from scratch. And that's what I like about this project, is that there is a variety of how far students are throughout the business process.
Mm-hmm. And we have actually Don joining us in the studio this morning. So Don, you've been mentoring students for a very long time. And you mentioned you've worked with some of these kids since they were in about eighth grade, is that correct? Well, How long have you had students?
Well, actually, good morning, Sean. The students I'm actually mentoring is in eighth grade. So that's been a great experience. John contacted us earlier this year, the Park City Angels, to see if we could help both financially and using the expertise of our members to help the pitch contest be successful. And it's, you know, we like the fact that all of these young people have drive and initiative. And we know from having, you know, in essence, Park City Angels conducts a pitch contest every month with entrepreneurs seeking funding from our group. So we know how hard it is to articulate your business idea and get it across in literally 10 minutes, because the rest of the time is Q&A with the judges. So, even adults, I've done a lot of mentoring of startup businesses to hone their pitches so that they can effectively communicate their problem, their solution, and how they're going to make it a success.
Mm-hmm. We hear that elevator pitch all the time. How hard is that to take, a kid has a great idea, but it takes them 30 minutes to explain it. How hard is it to distill something like that down into something that's precise, concise, and easily digestible by someone?
Well, you know, I could just, it's really hard. I think it's one of the hardest things entrepreneurs have to do is pitch, because they want to talk about their product or service for 15 minutes. And really, the audience just wants to hear it for about a minute and a half. Because there's lots of other subjects that they want to cover in that 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So, John, it looks like we'll have a pretty broad spectrum of projects the students are bringing to the judges. What are some of these pitches that stand out to you?
So there are two of them that are clothing brands. They're trying to have clothing brands that are targeted towards the youth. We have one student who is doing a media platform in which he's selling clothing and also photography, which is really interesting. And we even have a student who's selling metal insect sculptures. He welds and creates metal insect culture. So that's really cool. We have a wide variety of the six students in this competition have a wide variety of businesses that they're trying to create and pitch to the judges tomorrow. So it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Don, what about you? Any projects stick out to you?
Well, I'm only mentoring one young woman who's in the eighth grade and is coming up with a line of skincare products. Mm-hmm. So, when I was in eighth grade, I was totally useless. So I'm pretty impressed that she has this business idea, articulates it, tells us how she's going to sell it and how she's going to go about expanding her product line.
Very interesting and very topical as well. I believe the New York Times had a big Sunday feature on the beauty and skincare industry, so very topical.
Well, the whole thing is natural ingredients versus, like, your lip balms have all of these artificial ingredients that are bad for you. So this is a whole natural ingredient play.
Mm-hmm. So, John, tell us a little bit about some of the prizes being offered. I understand there is some actual prize money involved.
So a big part of this whole job for me was trying to raise money. And so we've raised over $5,000 for this competition. So the plan is, as of now, we will be giving over $3,000 to the winning contestant, and a little over $1,000 to the second place, and a little under $1,000 to the third place. So we've raised a majority of our money actually from the Park City Angels. I sent a cold email to Donald Roll about, like, in February, and then he's been helping me through connections and contacts to try to get as much fundraising as I can. And my goal was $5,000, and I actually beat it by $700. I raised $5,700, which is very exciting. And I have to thank Park City Angels and Donald Roll for that. So.
Wonderful.
So I could give a shout out to some of the corporate sponsors.
Yeah,
in addition
go ahead.
To Park City Angels and our members, Alex Brown, who is one of our members, the Alex Brown Brokerage, a division of Raymond James, Med Mountain Ventures, which is a venture fund focused on medical technology, A23, and iWin are all corporate sponsors, in addition to about a dozen individual sponsors.
Mm-hmm. If I could go back to that prize money real quick, John, will there be any restrictions on how it is used? I know sometimes, especially when it comes to children and youth receiving prize money, sometimes there are restrictions attached to it. Is there anything like that, or can the kids do what they will with any of the money they might win?
Well, the three students who are going to be winning money, we know that they're going to be hardworking students, and they're not going to just use it for something not in their business. So we know that the kids or the contestants are going to come into this contest with a plan. If they were to win this money, what they would be doing with it. And that's part of the pitch for tomorrow, is that they're going to have to include how the funds would actually go back in their business and, you know, change the business and create some change.
Mm-hmm. So, Don, what will the judges really be looking to hear in this competition? What makes a winning pitch?
I think it's a big part of the pitch is the believability of the presenter, because they're the ones that have to make it happen. So the presenter needs to connect with the judges. And, you know, there's a variety of ideas, but if the presenter doesn't connect with the judge, that the judge believes that this person can execute the plan, then they stand very little chance of winning.
And speaking of
some
of these...
And there's a bunch of criteria, but That is the number one criteria.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of some of the judges we will have, technology executives, a leader at Vivint Smart Home, so some real kind of heavy hitters in the Utah business world.
Yes, we helped John bring together the judging panel, which everybody was very enthusiastic about helping out.
Mm-hmm. And so, John, presentations are in person and also virtual. So kind of tell us how the details of how people can join in on this.
So we did give an option for the contestants to do it virtually, but I have confirmed that all six of the people pitching their product tomorrow will be in person. But everyone is available to watch this competition over Zoom, which is on my website, which is pitchpc.weebly.com. And everyone is available to watch it. We have our mentors, our judges, and some people from the PC Cats, and me and one other person working on this project with me will be in person watching the pitches. But everyone else is invited to attend over Zoom. So
wonderful. And that Zoom link will be on your website?
That Zoom link is the first thing on the website, yes, sir.
Wonderful, wonderful. Any in-person attendance guidelines?
Well, we definitely hope that it's mandatory that everyone wears their mask and there's going to be social distance. Everyone's going to be socially distanced, and that's about it. We just got to follow the COVID protocols at the school.
Well, sounds like it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful time. Anything either of you would like to add before we let you go?
No, I just we're looking really forward to the pitches tomorrow, and this is the first annual time that they're having a Pitch PC event, and we're hoping that it becomes an annual pitch contest.
Wonderful. Well, John and Don, thank you both so much for your time this morning, and best of luck tomorrow.
Thank you, Sean.
All right. Thank you.
That's John Trahan and Don Roll with the PC Caps. Well, TEDx Park City will be holding auditions for their annual TEDx Youth event April 13th and 14th at the Eccles Center at Park City High School. The auditions are open to all area students in grades 8 through 12. TEDx Park City founder Terry Orr told KPCW of the over 3,800 licensed TED organizations, Park City is one of only a handful that offers a youth program alongside their traditional lineup of events.
Out of that, there probably aren't 10 of us that do TEDx Youth. So what we do is we produce a day for the students, by the students, where they have a chance to give their own talks and where we, you know, play some interesting, uplifting, amusing little snippets and videos between them. We used to have a great lunch and all kinds of hands-on activities that this year we feel is probably not prudent, but we'll do that again when we can.
There was hope that this year's event would take place in person, but Orr said with many children still waiting for the COVID-19 vaccine, the 2020-21 edition of TEDx Youth will be done over Zoom. The auditions, however, will be held in person in front of a panel of judges at the Park City High School's George S. and Dolores Eccles Center at 3:30 p.m. on April 13th and 14th. Topics of past youth talks have run the gamut from how dinosaur socks are inspiring every time you put them on to what it's like growing up as a member of a minority community in Park City. The bottom line is if you have an idea or story you think needs sharing, TEDx Park City wants to hear it. After auditions, Orr hopes to have about a dozen speakers lined up for the main event on May 19th. Auditions are free. For more information or to sign up for an audition, visit TEDxParkCity.org.